for Monday, April 2nd, 2007. Gentlemen, we have a full agenda today. We're going to begin with the informational meeting. I'm going to open up an informational meeting on career schools, and we have Gina Wickstrom, who is here to give testimony and inform us about the career schools in Oregon. Please.
Yes, come forward.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, can the other presenters join me at the table at this time?
Only if you are in approval of that idea.
I absolutely am.
And if they promise to behave.
That I don't know. And I think, Andy, are we ready to roll? Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Gina Wickstrom. I'm the Executive Director of the Northwest Career Colleges Federation. We represent the private career sector in Idaho, Oregon, and Washington, representing approximately 720 schools, some more, some less, depending on the day and how entrepreneurial the world is feeling at that point. So thank you for the opportunity to come before you today and give you folks a little bit of information about private career colleges here in Oregon and how we are helping to build the educational and economy in Oregon. I'll just give you a little bit of an overview today, and then joining me will be the director of ITT Technical Institute, who will talk about the degree-granting institutions in the state. Siri McElliott will talk about the diploma certificate institutions. And then because we serve both our students and our employers, we have a student to talk to you as well, and an employer who hires graduates from our schools. So thank you. We'll just go ahead and get rolling. The private career college sector in Oregon has a long history of educating Oregon citizens. Some of our schools date back into the 1940s, where they were known as business schools and secretarial schools. And as I mentioned a little earlier, we serve two customers. We serve our students and we serve our employers that hire our graduates. We are the second largest provider of workforce education in Oregon. Of course, the community college system is the largest. And private career colleges prepare students for very specific careers in a wide array of occupations here in Oregon. And we do a number of programs, and we do it in response to employer demand. We recognize that it's absolutely essential that we prepare Oregon citizens for Oregon jobs. It's very relative education. And here in Oregon, we educate thousands of students each year, and we're very proud to do that. Our schools provide the education in a manner that helps the students stay in school and complete their education. Student retention is absolutely paramount to our success and to their success. We track field-related employment for our graduates. We believe this is an essential business imperative. We need to know where our students are getting jobs, and we need to ensure that our students are getting jobs after they complete their education. Therefore, it's absolutely essential that we ensure that our curriculum is the most up-to-date that is possible, and we work with our employers to make sure the education that we are providing our students is what they need. Private career colleges are very highly regulated. Some of our schools are accredited, and some are recognized by the state licensing or authorizing agencies as well. The schools that are accredited meet not only the high standards set forth by the state agencies, but also by the accrediting agency in meeting their standards. How many private career colleges are there in Oregon? I have just been informed by the Department of Education there are now over 300 licensed through that agency, and those are the non-degree institutions. There are 9 colleges that are authorized by the Oregon Degree Authority to grant degrees to our graduates, and 15 of our technical schools are approved by the United States Department of Education to offer student financial assistance. We believe that as members of the state's higher education system, private career colleges are absolutely essential to Oregon's future. By educating thousands of students, we do that at absolutely no cost to the taxpayers of Oregon. Additionally, as businesses, we are taxpayers helping the economy in Oregon as well. Our students attend year-round. We don't go on a traditional semester cycle. And so what that means is our students get through college quicker, which equates to them earning money sooner, and then that also means that they are paying taxes to the Oregon's economy quicker. So we think that that's all plays out to be something very good for the state. And additionally, we are very employer-driven, as we've talked about, and market-driven. We respond to Oregon's needs for a well-prepared workforce. That's kind of my overview of the sector in large and what I do on a day-to-day basis. This is my contact information. You folks have that, Mr. Chair, in a copy of the handout that has been provided for you. And now I think that you're probably very interested to hear from the folks that actually are educating these folks rather than me. So with that, Siri McElliott, who is president of Ashby College.
Thank you, Gina. Chairman Buckley and committee members, I'm very pleased to be here today, especially I'm back in Salem where my alma mater is right across the street, so it's very nice to be here. And I'm excited to give you a glimpse of what we do at Ashman College and the part that our sector plays in Oregon by helping students accomplish their educational goals. Again, my name is Siri McElliott, and I'm the campus president at Ashman College, Tiger Campus, used to be Vancouver Campus. We also have an institution called Everest College, which was Western Business College for a good number of years and has been educating folks for over 70 years as well. Our school provides diplomas in massage therapy, aromatherapy, and spa specialty, which prepares students for licensure in those respective fields. In addition, we provide a diploma in fitness training. My school currently has about 220 students, and of those students, 179 graduated last year, and we have tracked that 121 of them have retained employment in their field that they were interested in going in as they started school at Ashmead College. Again, our mission and our education objectives of the school prepare the students for advancement or the base skill set that they need for the career that they're entering. As a component of assisting our graduates, we provide career placement, our career services, and this is a critical part of our school component. So what our career services department does is they maintain relationships with the employers. In addition to that, they support our students in developing their skill set in interviewing, building their resume, and really preparing them for this industry that they're entering into. Another part of our mission is that we continually assess and evaluate our success at meeting these educational goals that we provide to our students. As an element of this, we also receive and maintain accreditation by the Accrediting Council for Continuing Education and Training, what is known as ACET. This is a national accrediting agency recognized by the U.S. Department of Education. ACET is a reliable authority that ensures that the quality of education or training provided by an institution it accredits. Recognized agencies promulgate quality standards that are used to evaluate institutions. Those who seek accreditation undergo a rigorous process of self-study and an on-site review. Once the institution is accredited, they are monitored by the accrediting body. And after the term of accreditation ends, the institution is reevaluated to ascertain if it should be allowed to maintain its accreditation. This process and the hallmark it gives institutions provides the public as well as policymakers the assurance that these institutions provide programs that meet and maintain quality standards. ASHME conducts its programs in an active learning environment. And what I mean by this is we really create an environment that engages our students in hands-on learning. We devote a good portion of our program to that hands-on learning environment, and our instructors are professionals with extensive experience in the field that they are teaching. Our classroom instruction is also provided with active learning in mind. Across all of our schools, we are engaging in a full-on training with our instructors that provide active learning methods for the adult learner. In addition to this, I'd like to give you a taste of what our ASHMEAD students go through in a 44-week experience. They are exposed to anatomy and physiology, kinesiology, Swedish full body massage, deep tissue massage, advanced massage techniques, seated massage, which you've probably seen when you've gone through the airport, and body mechanics and draping. All of these areas really prepare the massage therapist to obtain the licensure that's required by the state and also nationally and help them succeed in the workplace. Our graduates seek out employment in a variety of healthcare settings, and in addition to that, we have several self-employed individuals who go into massage therapy or fitness training. At this point, I would be pleased to answer any questions you may have. Thank you.
We'll wait until one more presentation. Please, proceed.
Thank you, Chairman Buckley and members of the committee. My name is Wayne Madlich. I am the director of ITT Technical Institute in Portland. In support of Oregon's strategy to support a technology-based economy, ITT Technical Institute offers bachelor degrees and associate degrees in fields like information technology, electronics technology, drafting and design, business, and criminal justice. In selecting the programs that we offer, we pay a lot of attention to the jobs that are on demand and the skills that the employers want from workers filling those positions. This direct link between skills and jobs is the reason students enroll in career colleges. But it really isn't about the schools, it's about the students. You've heard from both Gene and Siri on career colleges in general. I'd like to talk a little bit about our students, and then we have one of my students that will also talk to you. Many of our students would not have been considered academically strong in high school. Often they entered the world of work immediately after high school, and then they learned first-handed that the road to better career or to career advancement required some post-secondary education. Our average student is about 26 years old. Many of our students, and it's really fun to see this, are the first in their family ever to attend, let alone graduate, college. They've always had the support behind them saying, oh, college wasn't that important. And we know that sons and daughters of educated parents attend post-secondary school also. So to a degree, we're changing the culture of an entire family from that point on in having our students be the first to graduate in their families. They're all here for their own reason. If you asked any of our students, why are you here? They usually don't say to get educated. They say, I am here for a better job. I'm here to make more money. I'm here to support my family. I have two kids now, and I want a future for them. I want to learn something that's going to provide a future. They come to us needing a little bit more personalized assistance in a more applied learning environment. And they found that the traditional model of higher education didn't work for them. And I know that's the fact because we have right now 60 students in our school that have transferred from either state colleges or community colleges because they couldn't fit into that traditional large class role. Many of our students are working. In fact, a significant amount of our students come to us earning around $8 or $8.50 an hour for an annual salary of about $17,000. They're just making it. And a lot of those students are trying to support young families. 80% of our graduates, once they graduate a two-year program at ITT Tech, where we have four-year bachelor programs also, are employed in the field that they study within 6 months of graduation. The average salary for a two-year degree being $31,600. That's 80% increase in salary attributable directly to education. That's 80% more dollars injected into the Oregon economy and your tax base. Last year, we graduated 140 students. That 140 students recurring year after year, we figure, is injecting about $2 million a year into the Oregon economy. That's in addition to my $3.2 million staff salaries that we pay the on an ongoing basis. And as Gina said, we do all this with no taxpayer dollars. Students are individuals. They have different kinds of needs, educational experiences in elementary and secondary schools, and they have of varying levels of education success, and they have a different levels of confidence in attending school. All the students don't earn or learn the same way. Some find that they cannot succeed in a learning environment that relies strictly on instructor lectures. So they continue to look elsewhere until they find a college that can teach the way they learn. And that's what we do, is we try to alter our program so we teach the way our average student learns. Many students have told me that what they like the best about ITT Technical Institute is our applied learning approach, which supplements theory lectures with laboratory exercises that include visual, kinesthetic, or hands-on, and spatial learning opportunities. It isn't that there's one way of teaching, or one way is right or one way is wrong. It's which way is best for that particular student. That means that the students need a choice. They need to be able to choose among the many options and find the instructional model that works best for them. At ITT and other career colleges, we do teach the way that they like to learn. We should ensure that we place no barriers that discourage these students from attaining higher education. Yet the more than 7,200 students enrolled in career colleges are denied equal access to the Oregon Opportunity Grant. I know that we can all agree that better educated workforce means a stronger economy. The more workers that we have with college-level experience, the better we will be at attracting the kind of 21st century business and jobs that create a vibrant economy for Oregon. Career college students make a significant contribution to the economy. They work hard to balance the responsibilities of work, family, and education because they want their chance to participate in the American opportunity and the American dream. Career college students deserve the same level of help that we give all other college students. They, too, deserve to participate where they can in the Oregon Opportunity Grant program. Thank you very much for your kind attention. Thank you for your support that makes it a choice for those students who want to attend career college.
Thank you very much. Any questions, gentlemen?
Just one, Mr. Chair.
It was that
fun. Thank you. Is ITT... Does it fall under the ODE, or is it...
We're under the ODA.
ODA.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Yeah. Thank you.
Alan.
Contreras.
Yeah, Contreras. Yeah.
Great. What's ODA?
Office of Degree Authorization. It sits within the Oregon Student Assistance Commission, and so Alan reports to the commission. He's the director, and they manage degree, you know, legitimacy, and they find the good people and go after the bad people.
Yeah. He approves every program for us. And every instructor that we have has to qualify under his umbrella.
Mr. Chair, I can respond to that as well.
Absolutely.
I mentioned early on that I represent the states of Idaho, Oregon, and Washington. And with that, I work with, as you can imagine, state agencies, authorizing agencies in each of those states. And I have to say that in Oregon, the Oregon Degree Authority is probably one of the most thorough and conscientious that we run up against in the three states. So when someone says they are authorized to offer degrees in Oregon, it's kind of like a template for the other states. Well, if they made it in Oregon, they can make it here. And so that's kudos to that agency.
Very good to hear. Representative Clem, follow.
One additional comment. A few years ago, the community really had to step up, actually, because the state gutted the general fund budget for this activity. It's really the purpose of every degree holder, wherever they went, to have state government make sure that all degrees are valid, and when you get one, it means something.
Mm-hmm.
But for the last several years, we've been actually having the applicants pay the full weight because we took all the general fund out at one point, 70% reduction in 1 year. And so it's really the schools who are now paying for Alan's time in order to have everyone else, whether they went to one of these schools or not, have a meaningful degree. So I'd like to thank you for that.
Mr. Chair, if I may, please, we absolutely agree. And that's why we support regulation. We believe good regulation creates good education. And with that, we see that happening. And thank you for those words. We appreciate it.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Couple more.
Who owns ITT?
It's a public company. ESI, ITT is owned by a national publicly owned company.
What's the name of that company?
It's ITT, Educational ITT Services.
Yeah. And where is it headquartered?
Indiana.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Is it a for-profit or non-profit?
For-profit.
So you get hit twice on the opportunity grant guidelines, one headquarters and the other, for-profit nature.
You know, we don't see the opportunity grant helping the school as much as the students, or students have that gap, and the way that bill is designed, it really, really would help students in being able to afford a little bit better. We'd love to have you listen to one of our students.
Well, we have to hear your concerns. I have a couple questions before we throw you off there. Can I ask what your tuition is at your schools, please?
It ranges from about $13,000 to $14,000.
Okay.
And ours, for a two-year degree, runs around $30,000, $32,000.
Thank you very much. Ms. Bickstrom, is there any information available on how Oregon is doing compared to other states in terms of our private career schools, graduating students who are getting jobs and keeping jobs? Is there information available?
Well, Mr. Chair, that's a bit of a challenge, and we would love to have those numbers for you. Because we're 300 private businesses, there's no one single mechanism to capture that information, other than our accredited institutions that I referenced earlier, because of their required accountability.
Right.
So we can identify that as a general general outcome. But as far as putting our arms around the total numbers of students that are served and what their outcomes are, we hope to work with the Oregon Department of Education on that. We can, the ODA schools accredited, we can get that.
Right.
The other folks, we'd like to work with the agency in order to be able to provide that information to the legislature and the general public.
Very good. Thank you so much.
Representative Lynn. Thank you very much. And could you tell me, do you have any dropout rate from, even though your institution come from the other universities, but very successful, but do you have any low dropout rate?
Well, you can look at that a couple different ways. And I guess to compare apples to apples, we don't have anything because there's no published numbers on the public side. But the estimate is a typical community college has a completion rate, which means for everybody that starts day one actually ends up getting a degree in the teens, less than 20%. We're about 50% completion.
Okay.
And we're about, and as I mentioned earlier, 80% of our graduates are employed in the field that they study within 6 months after graduation.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
To address that, on a national level, what affects that completion rate is primarily the length of the program. The shorter the program, generally the higher the student completion rate, the higher the graduation rate. The longer the program, an associate or bachelor level, of course, from the point that they start from a freshman year to their graduation senior year, the numbers aren't as strong, but you folks are I'm sure used to hearing that. But again, we believe what we have at this point are national numbers, and it's as Wayne has said, it's generally around 50% for our degree programs, higher than that for our certificate programs.
Okay, just one more question.
Representative Lim.
And according to the information you've given me, those students going to your institution, the average are about 26 years old, whatever. And then they are working just minimum wage or in that category. How could they afford to pay for the tuition?
Well, we're Title IV, so they have a combination. A lot of them, about 54% of our students right now, and it goes between 46 and 54, are Pell eligible. So they get a combination of Pell grants and Stafford loans and some personal financing. But they put it together, and we have very, very low default on student loans. They all go through, and they get pretty good jobs. To answer also earlier, part of our placement, part of the part of the career colleges, we all have placement departments that help students locate jobs. And most of our students that take work assignments are not to advertise jobs. The employers come to us. They like the product that's coming out of the schools. So very, very few of the jobs are ever advertised. So it's almost like a job agency for the employers, too.
Thank you so much for being here. Thank you for the work.
Thank you very much for your time.
And we do have a student that would like to testify.
And an employer.
Please. Brian.
Great.
And Wayne, if you would play musical chairs for a moment.
Absolutely.
Mr. Chair, we're delighted to share with you the stories from one of our students and from an employer. And so if it's acceptable to you, we'll hear first from the student.
Very good.
Brian?
Very good. Welcome.
Gentlemen, thank you. My name is Brian Page. I am a certified information system security professional, and I'm also a student graduating in 7 weeks at ITC Technical Institute with my bachelor's in information system security. Mr. Matledge asked me to come and speak, so I wrote down a testimonial, which I'll read to you right now. I started attending ITT Technical Institute in 2003. I had recently been laid off from my job, which back in the early 2000s, a lot of people were starting to see. I was looking for a way to support my wife and myself. We knew we'd just gotten married, and so I was looking for a way to support her and myself. I chose to attend school at ITT Tech and attained an Associate's of Science in Computer Networking Systems. The classes provided me with the skills necessary to support a wide range of data communication networks. The classes at ITT Tech were small, so I got the attention that I required so that I could learn the curriculum and succeed in each class that I took. Each class also provided me with hands-on training that helped by providing real-world scenarios and solutions to the problems people face in the business world. This high standard set forth by ITT Tech has drawn students and their families to Oregon. One such peer in my class has moved his family all the way from Texas because the ITT Tech Portland, Oregon campus was the only one that offered a bachelor's program in information system security.
Hmm.
This is also a very highly sought-after skill. Due to some of the problems with the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, Enron scandal, Viacom, and companies like that. ITT Tech has also developed partnerships with businesses in the community. They do this to tailor our curriculum so that they ensure we have the most up-to-date skills and access to equipment that we need to provide those skills to our employers. These are probably the key reasons why I chose ITT Tech. When getting both of my degrees. A little bit about my career since I started attending ITT Tech. After I attained my associate's degree, I took a job with Komodo Systems as a help desk technician. In the 2 years since working at Komodo Systems, I've been promoted 4 times and now earn a salary of over $55,000 a year. I have full health coverage for me and my family at no additional out-of-pocket costs, and I also get paid vacation every year. The executive management at Komodo Systems have commented on several occasions that I'm a key employee due in part to my education. And because of this, they have invested several thousands of their own dollars in continuing my education outside of ITT Technical Institute. Komodo Systems is a Portland-based company that provides web-based collaboration services to public school districts in Oregon, Washington, and Texas. The services provided by Komodo Systems run on equipment that require in-depth knowledge of data communication systems and extensive understanding of information system security standards such as the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, the Children's Internet Protection Act, and the Health Insurance Portability Accountability Act, which help protect the interests of our clients. I'd like to sum it up by going over some of the reasons that I feel that state funding could help the students at ITT. Even with everything ITT Tech has to offer students, I feel that potential students do not take advantage of the opportunity due to lack of funding. Given additional grant funding by the state of Oregon, more students will be given the opportunity to obtain an education from a school that provides up-to-date curriculum, skilled faculty that has years of experience in the field that they teach, and a lifetime job placement program that has a high success rate of matching students to the right job and employer. All of these reasons in turn help stimulate and grow Oregon's economy and places Oregon in a position to be a leader in the high technology industry. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you very much.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Solport is a small technologies company in Tigard, Oregon, and we founded ourselves in November of 2004 as a small entrepreneurship of five individuals.
State your name for the record.
Oh, Wayne Vandekrak, sorry, with Solport.
Thanks, man.
And so we've been in business for about 2.5 years now. We've had a pretty aggressive growth rate. We're employing currently 43 individuals in our office in Portland. And so that aggressive hiring program has put, you know, to a certain degree, a tremendous strain on the company in for us to be able to look for recruiting channels to be able to get qualified candidates into our company. Last year, we did about $3.5 million in revenue, and recruiting probably was one of our bigger challenges throughout the year, and it looks like in 07 that it will continue to be so. Of the 43, I think it's now 13 employees came from ITT.
Hmm.
We currently cover about 130,000 automated teller machines or ATMs nationwide, and that is what we do. We provide outsourced technical support for automated teller machines throughout the country, at least in all 48 states, and we do that the full gamut. So if a financial institution or a business owner owns an ATM, we will provide services to keep that ATM operational. Our annual payroll last year was about $1.5 million, and it's looking to go to about $2.2 million this year. Our average employee age is 28.8, so we tend to employ a younger age group within the company, and we tend to attract people who have very much passion for technology, of fixing things, especially anything that is hardware and software related. Why we chose ITT is we experimented with a variety of junior colleges in the Portland metro area. ITT was one of the colleges that immediately started developing a rapport and a partnership with us. We had gone to PCC, PSU, et cetera. And although you can utilize their bulletin boards for employment purposes, et cetera, they tend to be less aggressive in partnering with you to make sure that you are getting the right candidate, but as well that just the motivation level, I think, is less at a state-run faculty or a college to go on and above for you to get the right candidate. We've discovered that the person who generally goes to ITT is someone who, by default, has a interest and passion for technology, for fixing things, for being able to troubleshoot, to resolve. And so our experience with the ITT candidate, their graduate, has been very positive. We, to this date, have not seen an ITT graduate leave the organization. We find that this person has a fundamental knowledge of hardware, software, basic academics such as writing and mathematics, and is very motivated to work and excel within a small company. We also have a very close working relationship with the recruiting department at ITT, and I serve on their advisory board, so it can work both ways. On one level, they are able to get us the candidates that we need, and their recruiters come out to Solport on a regular basis to make sure that they continually understand what our needs are for their graduates. But at the same time, we're able to participate on their advisory board and give constructive feedback as to how our business climate is changing and our needs are changing, et cetera. I that would sum it up. I mean, I think ITT, their strong point over the last 2 years, again, has been able to function as a recruiting channel that allows us to tap into graduates who are qualified, who are knowledgeable, and who are very motivated to go to work. We have, as of recent, increased the bar for new hire applicants that they at least have a two-year college degree. Reason for that being is that in our experience, hiring directly out of high school has not given us the candidate with the experience, definitely, but also the knowledge base to do basic functions within our company. So we have moved that bar up, and we are very appreciative of private career colleges such as ITT to be able to provide that recruiting channel for us. Without that, I think we would have been much less successful last year.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Representative Clem.
One question that might end up being for a gentleman in the audience, actually, but you made a comment about the motivation level, you know, your perception, at least of the motivation level, working with different institutions. And I wondered, do career schools, or ITT in particular, have financial incentives for placements?
Actually, Mr. Please. Chair, I can answer that. No, we are prohibited from paying any kind of incentive.
I thought, yeah. So it's so not necessarily based on, you know, any...
Customer service.
Yeah.
Customer service to our employers and customer service to our students.
And I would, just in defense of Oregon State, I worked in the career center there. They did a really good job with the warehouse, I remember, and other companies who came onto campus. So I'm sure that it sort of varies on the niche of the institution, but it's interesting perspective.
And if I may, I think larger state colleges do a great job with some of the larger companies in the state of Oregon. We are a small company, so we do tend to fall under the radar. So to get that level of customer service from a private career college is generally something we would not get anywhere else. So.
Representative Kremel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Page, I'm just curious, because earlier it was alluded to different students have different learning styles and that sort of thing. Do you know what your learning style is, and did ITT evidently must have really appealed to your learning style, but do you know what your learning style is by any chance?
I fall into the category of first I read it and then I have to do it. I can't just read a book, and a lot of people can. They can read a book and they can write along the answer to any question you ask them. I have to come back and I have to have someone sit with me and, you know, like, okay, here's where you're going wrong. You know, I can only go so far with the book. Once someone sits down with me and starts pointing out where my problems are, then I start getting set and I start bringing myself up to their level.
Okay. Terrific. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you so much for coming to testify. Let us know.
Mr. Chair, member of the committee, thank you very much for this opportunity.
Our pleasure. Thank you. I'm going to close the informational hearing on private career schools in the state of Oregon. I'm going to open up a public hearing. I'm going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2579. Gentlemen, this is a bill that I believe we've heard twice before. Oh, yeah, that's right. We carried it over. We did hear this down in Ashland. And we do have some folks who are willing to come testify today. Mr. Olson, would you please give us an overview of House Bill 2579? And Mr. Wagner, would you step forward while Mr. Olson is giving the summary?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2579, which we heard once before, February 23rd, in the full committee in Ashland, which not everyone was able to attend, increases the number of directors appointed to the State Board of Higher Education from 1 to 2 members, and then reapportions the representation of faculty at public institutions of higher education between these two members. You have before you a staff measure summary, which goes in a little more into the detail, and I think Mr. Wagner might also have some more detail on how these directors would be apportioned. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Mr. Wagner, welcome.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Rob Wagner. I'm the Director of Political and Legislative Affairs for the American Federation of Teachers here in Oregon. We have locals at 5 of the 7 Oregon University System campuses. And this is the what I'm calling the long and winding road toward passage of House Bill 2579. The only reason I say that isn't because there's been any real opposition that we've heard of. It's just because we had a very fun time driving down through the snowy foothills down to Ashland for a hearing back in late February. And just a little bit about the bill. I know there are a couple other folks here to testify. I did want to submit testimony from the Oregon Student Association in support of the bill. Brett Roulette had a conflict, but he said if he didn't make it back in time, he could at least submit his written comments. And in terms of what the bill does, it's a little bit of background. Right now on the State Board of Higher Education, there's one faculty member and two student members. And the faculty member, although it's a relatively recent position, has never come from our regional campuses. That includes Southern Oregon University, Western, Eastern, OIT. And I think that the regionals, our members certainly feel this, share a real special mission and a real different perspective. We've heard about what's happened down in Ashland. We've heard all kinds of stuff around campus closures. And I would just say that this is not some sort of end run on the board. It isn't trying to make this an employee board. You'd be taking the percentage on the board from just under 10% to about 16% that are represented by faculty. And also by statute, faculty are prohibited from commenting on anything regarding collective bargaining. So this isn't some sort of way to pack with benefits or salaries. But with everything that we've heard around the 2 hours of testimony from our faculty that were here last week, in addition, in the wake of the co-chair's budget, that really, we'll just say we're very disappointed in where we are right now, and we'll be working very hard for the remainder of the session on securing additional revenue for the university system. We think right now is this highlights in a critical time for maybe some additional attention from faculty and the special role that they play. I think it's a very modest proposal, and as I said, we haven't heard directly from anyone in opposition. We enjoy broad bipartisan support in terms of the co-sponsorship on the legislation. I know that this bill was scheduled, as you mentioned, on Ashland. We traveled to testify there, had it up last week. We would encourage your passage of this legislation this session.
Thank you, Mr. Wagner. Thank any you. Questions?
I have one.
Representative Greenlee.
Good afternoon, Rob.
Hi.
When PSU becomes a part of the Portland Metropolitan University System and moves out of OUS, would you assume their representative wouldn't be included in this?
Chair Buckley's Representative Greenlee. I think there might be a bill up for discussion a little bit later in this committee. I will say that our members would be very interested in looking again at the composition of the board when Portland State University fuses with OHSU.
Diplomatically. Any other questions?
Mr.
Chair.
Representative Lim. And could you give me why you needed one more faculty members? I don't see any real reason other than two students represented, and so you should have two faculty too. Is that it, or what's the basic reasons for that?
Well, it's a good Representative Buckley, Chair Buckley, Representative Lim. It's a great question. I think it's just looking at our regional campuses and the faculty there, I think, share a unique perspective in terms of the students that are there, in terms of their perspectives and the courses that they teach. So, and I think you really hit the nail on the head. This is a situation where you have two students, and this would be adding a parity to the board with our faculty representative position. So,
okay. Thank you, Mr. Wagner.
Thank you very much.
Chancellor, would you wish to come to weigh in on this bill, sir?
Thank you, Chair Buckley, members of the committee. For the record, my name is George Pernsteiner. I'm the Chancellor of the University System. I don't usually use my title when I introduce myself, and I did so advisedly in this case because we're talking about my board, and so whatever I say here can have an impact on the composition of that board in 3 or 4 months. So I am mindful of that, and I do not take a position on the bill, but instead I thought I would let you know a little bit of background that might inform your discussion about this bill. The Association of Governing Boards for Colleges and Universities is a national organization that is made up of people who are board members and chief staff to board members of the public and private colleges and universities around the country. AGB for some time has had a viewpoint that has said that boards should take the broadest viewpoint possible, in this case a statewide viewpoint, in the work that they do, because this is a statewide board that is responsible for all of the universities in the state.
And so AGB typically counsels against representation from specified groups as a means for selection. Doesn't mean you can't do it. Mm-hmm. They just believe that it's probably better not to if you have a choice. HB 2579 disaggregates the board and raises the question of which groups might, should, could be represented. Some years ago, the legislature agreed that students should be represented on the board, and they placed students on the board about 30 years ago. And those students can come from any of the campuses, and currently both of them are from regional campuses. And they have served well in those roles for all the time that they have been on the board. But the question is, what are the organizations, what are the groups that might be represented on a board if we begin to look at the board as a representational body instead of a statewide body? Students, faculty, staff, employers, community organizations, individual types of businesses. We've had various expressions of interest in what we do, from agriculture, forestry, high technology, and from various parts of the state. So as you consider whether or not to begin segmenting the representation of the board, you might consider the various kinds of representation that others may want at different times. And is this an appropriate approach to be taken? I believe the board has served the state well over the last three quarters of a century by taking a statewide view that is not bound by loyalties to other groups, which isn't to say that any individual board members would be so bound in the future. I'm not arguing that. What I'm talking about is the framework which we erect can lead to results, and we should carefully consider that framework as we look at it. Would it be difficult to keep the statewide interest paramount if we go in the direction of specific representation? Now, of course, specific representation can work. I remember reading about a successful effort led by a leader named Noah. And he orchestrated a voyage with a crew of two from each species, and he and the ark survived. But then they only had to do it for 40 days and 40 nights. So I would entertain any questions.
Is that our history lesson?
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chancellor. Gentlemen, I'm going to jump around the agenda just a little bit in consideration of Representative Hunt's time. We'll come back to House Bill 2579. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing for House Bill 2579 for right now. And I'm going to open up a work session on House Bills, I'll let Representative Hunt talk about both, House Bills 2633 and House Bill 2845. Representative Hunt, please make yourself comfortable. Welcome back to the Education Committee.
Did you say 2633?
2635.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do I need to make myself comfortable because you have many questions
That's
for me
right.
today?
Okay. That's right. Get comfortable.
For the record, Representative Dave Hunt from Clackamas County. The simpler of the two, I think, might be to start with 2633. You do have, I believe, dash two amendments
we do
before you.
Representative, I'll interrupt you briefly to give Mr.
I'm
Olson the opportunity to describe the bills to us again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative, members of the committee. We discussed House Bill 2633 on March 26th. We had an amendment before us. There was some consensus work done. We have a dash two amendment before you that replaces the entire text. The key changes are it talks about providing referring a person to vocational training at schools or programs rather than providing vocational rehabilitational training. And it adds some definitions clarifying the difference between vocational rehabilitation training and vocational training. This, in my understanding, this amendment was worked with the Department of Human Services and it's a consensus amendment and is aimed at clarifying the intent of the bill without causing any complication in the rehabilitation training work done by the Department of Human Services.
Okay, good. Thank you, Mr. Wilson. Do you want to speak briefly on the other bill as well?
Yes, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2845, likewise, we discussed on March 26th, and the only change on that one as the Dash 3 amendment compared to the Dash 2, which we saw last week, is it clarifies the section on the audits. It no longer talks about having the Secretary of State doing the audit. Rather, it requires career schools to submit an audited financial report signed by an independent certified public accountant. And then the Department of Education role would be to conduct program audits of career schools as provided by rule of the State Board of Education. So there's no longer discussion of the career, of the Secretary of State doing the audit. So the whole issue, Representative Crummell, that we were discussing before about who we decline and things like that appears to be no longer an issue because it's the wording has changed to have a independent financial audit by a CPA. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Rules. Gentlemen, I believe we have Representative Hunt for just several minutes. Do you have to leave it too, or are you all right?
I'm at your disposal, Mr. Chair.
All right, very good. Please proceed then.
The changes that Mr. Olson just referenced in 2633, if you look at on that first page of the Dash 2 amendments to 2633, line 21 and 22, it now says this section does not apply to vocational rehab training, vocational rehabilitation training. That's the main thing, and you can see the definition of vocational rehab training at the bottom of page 3 in the Dash 2s. Fundamentally, what that means, I think, in layperson's terms, is that they're, fundamental things. If somebody needs basic training in how to ride the bus, how to use a telephone, those kind of very core issues, that's not what we're trying to go after here. We're talking about real, what I would consider kind of true training, which this now defines as vocational training, not vocational rehab training. And so there was no intent to limit things in that way. So by dividing up the definition, hopefully you put the more very basic skills training off in one category, and the real core career training in another. And that's what we're trying to get at here in terms of where those dollars can flow. So it would leave in the other requirements in terms of it can still go to community colleges, still go to higher ed institutions, still go to OHSU, still go to career schools, still go to registered apprenticeship programs. But that would then be the entirety in terms of those legitimate career dollars. Maybe I should stop on that one before getting into the complexity of the other one, Mr. Chair.
Any questions, gentlemen? Representative Greenlee.
I'm a little confused, so I would appreciate a little help. And I assume a majority leader can help a bit. I've always assumed vocational rehabilitation training was training for somebody to take a job. And why would the Department of Human Services, be sending somebody for vocational training as opposed to sending them for voc rehab training? I mean, is there a new department?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee, I believe that they offer a variety of training to a variety of individuals. Some are obviously needing training to specifically enter a different occupation because of some kind of injury or inability to continue their previous work. That kind of training can be done at career schools, community colleges, universities, etc. This other training they offer, I believe, is for more severely impaired individuals who need how to learn how to do those very basic skills. These are skills that can't be taught at accredited schools. And so through the Office of Voc Rehab Services, they do both today. This gives them a clear definition of what those two are.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Crummell.
Never mind.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Greenlee.
I'm trying to get my arms around this slightly. What's the problem that this bill will solve?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee, today there is nothing in statute that prohibits the expenditure of voc that limits the expenditure of voc rehab dollars to licensed institutions. They can be spent on the Greenlick School of Voc Rehab, even if you are not registered or not licensed by the state.
That's the Greenlick School and Storm Door Company.
Okay, very good.
It's going to merge, actually, with the way it's
So the original intent of the bill was to narrow the scope. We narrowed it just slightly too much in the original bill, and that's why you see the dash twos here to leave those kind of rehabilitative services out.
Thank you.
Did you get a comment on the other bill?
I'd be happy to, Mr. Chair. Thank you. In terms of House Bill 2845, as was explained by Mr. Olson, the dash two amendments that we had had, and as Representative Crummell pointed out, were drafted in a way that it was directing the department directing the Secretary of State to conduct audits, and nobody was really happy with that amendment. So this language attempts to get at the same goal, to still require these career schools to submit an audited financial report, not done by the Secretary of State or the department or the state at all, done in the private sector, but it requires them to have it done and to submit it. But then it does authorize program audits of the career schools by the department, taking on a new role there. Again, really with the core intent of making sure that we've got career schools that are operating effectively and serving their students effectively, and that we're trying to weed out the bad apples, Mr. Chair, not bad actors. I would never refer to bad actors. So these amendments, we worked with the Department of Ed and the Secretary of State to craft these. The Department of Ed believes that this language, as it's constructed in the dash threes, does give them enough latitude and authority to be able to effectively get at any programmatic concerns in terms of them, in terms of these career schools overpromising what they're actually delivering students, with the financial aspect taken by them being required to submit the financial audits that are done in the private sector. I will also note, because I noted at the last hearing you had on this, that we had changed the phrasing around arbitration clauses in the earlier amendment, and still in this amendment, it now references a prohibition on binding arbitration. So arbitration can still be required of students when they enroll, but binding arbitration clauses can no longer be allowed. I think I had mentioned that we had done that at the request of the Northwest Career Schools Association because they had expressed concern about outright prohibition of all arbitration agreements. We accepted their proposal, and they had agreed to the compromise. I will tell you that at noon today, the Northwest Career Schools Association approached my staff to say that they could no longer support the compromise that they had originally suggested. I still support the inclusion of this binding arbitration prohibition. And I think it makes sense. Several other states have experienced problems with career schools requiring binding arbitration and of their students. Fortunately, we've not yet seen that tactic. Rather than wait until we start to see that tactic by some bad apple schools in the future, I think this is an opportunity to get out ahead of that, learn from the experience in other states. Because arbitration is a very costly process. Career school students are obviously often very low income and can't afford to be represented by counsel in these arbitration processes. Many of the career schools have teams of lawyers that can serve them in a case of a binding arbitration agreement. This creates a more level playing field where you can still have an arbitration process at play to resolve disputes, but not the ability of the career schools to require binding arbitration as part of the student agreements.
Any questions on this bill, gentlemen? Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hunt, you said that the Schools Association had that they no longer support the compromise. And the compromise was what again?
changing it from a prohibition on any arbitration agreements to a prohibition on just binding arbitration agreements. So they can still put in an arbitration agreement. They just cannot require that the students agree to binding arbitration.
But follow up, Mr. Chair?
Well,
but they had brought the compromise forward, is that?
Originally, yeah, they had expressed the concern, and they were okay up until noon today with prohibiting just binding arbitration.
Oh, okay. So just as a clarification, Mr. Chair, so it wasn't that they wanted to prohibit all arbitration. They didn't want to prohibit any arbitration. Is that correct?
I think that's where they are today. Yes, sir. Mr. Chair, Representative.
And are we going to have the opportunity to hear from the association, Mr. Chair, with regards to...
Would you care to comment on this? From the? Is there anyone here from the...
Yeah, they're both still
here. Okay.
Well, Gina's still here, so...
Yeah. Any further questions for Representative Hunt before we send him on his way?
Mr. Chair, just one clarification. What's the definition, just arbitration and a binding arbitration?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lim, you should probably consult an attorney for the specific answer to that. I hate to give you too much of a layperson's answer, but my understanding is that when you have a binding arbitration process, you lock someone into a process that often involves counsel representing them on both sides, and then you get to the end of the arbitration process, and that is both sides are... it's binding. Both sides must accept the outcomes. The problem is with that, if you've got an unlevel playing field going in, one side represented by a very experienced counsel, a low-income student, not necessarily represented by anyone, you don't necessarily have a fair process. You still have the binding result at the end, but you don't necessarily have a fair process going in.
Okay. Thank you. This helps.
If you'd stay for one moment, we'll let the representative from the career schools come up. And if you'll, again, announce yourself for the record, I'd appreciate it.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Gina Wickstrom. I'm Executive Director of the Northwest Career Colleges Federation. First of all, we apologize for the confusion. We are not attorneys. And I have in the
That's
last
okay,
week
we.
Had an intense education on the steps from mediation to binding arbitration in an attempt to understand this. And our concern is number one with the student, such as we understand the intent of the bill is. So when we started getting information from legal counsel identifying what these different steps were, we weren't convinced that removing that arbitration was in the best interest of the student, because frankly the schools have more money than the students have, and therefore, you know, if it goes to binding arbitration, if we don't have binding arbitration, then it can go through the process, whereas our fear is that if it is appealed, the school has more money, and now the student or the former student, whoever fits that role, doesn't have the money to go on and do the appeal process. So I attempted to put those thoughts into words and why we felt that maybe, if I understand what the attorneys are saying, it's not in the best interest of the student, although I understand the intent, which is to if there's arbitration goes on and the student feels like they got shortchanged, they aren't locked into that decision. But then as I researched arbitration, there's these independent folks that come in and they're nonpartisan. Mm-hmm. But I understand there could be some hesitation that maybe there is a partisan by the part. So if I've done anything except muddy this issue up at all, I apologize, because to me it's a very complex issue. And it's the line between protecting the student, ensuring that the student has the best possible outcome, not 3 years of court, but 30 days of conclusion. And so we support the intent. We then further discovered that there was a Oregon rule that required circuit court to do arbitration if the claim is under $50,000. Well, then I got really confused because I wondered if we're doing what we can't do. So that is why at the nth hour you got this information, because it took me this long to put that information together. Representative, and I apologize for the late hour on that. But again, understanding the intent, but just sharing with you all what has been discovered in the last week.
Thank you very much. Representative Hunt, do you know of other states that have actually put in statute the banning of buying arbitration?
That is a question I'm not sure the answer of, Mr. Chair. I know that there have been, I know that there, in many other states, there has been experience with career schools that have had, that required binding arbitration among their students and that have intentionally used that as a way to discourage and prevent students from seeking remedies against those schools. And so I think the experience in other states has been clear with states, with schools requiring binding arbitration. I'm not familiar specifically with whether other states have yet prohibited after they've had the bad experiences.
Very good. Thank you very much. Any other additional questions, gentlemen? Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, is this intended to be a fee bill also?
Mr. Crummell. There is a...
In Section 6,
fee increase,
there appears
like.
Fee increases of all of the fees. Is there any feeling on the part of the proponents or opponents of the fees?
That hasn't come up in testimony thus far, a concern over...
And does this bill have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means?
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Olson.
Mr. Chair, if I might, I left off on the staff measure summary. My apologies. There is a subsequent referral on this bill to the Joint Ways and Means Committee, and my understanding is, and perhaps someone could testify to this, but that the discussion of the fees was discussed previously with the career colleges, so it's... but they could probably speak more directly. I think we had some testimony on that last time we discussed it.
If I might, Mr. Chair.
Representative Clinton.
The thing that would be interesting for me, I guess, I'm comfortable also waiting and letting Ways and Means sort that part out as we go, but the change to having the schools provide an audit, a financial audit or consolidated audit statement versus the FTE and ODE having to go out and do that might, you know, make a change in the fee program. Now, we did discuss, I think, still doing program audits, so it may not relieve the need for additional person, but I believe the discussion was we might need another person.
Correct.
At Office of Career Schools, and it would be interesting, at least for Ways and Means, I'm sure, to hear what the relationship is between this change and the audit. Who does the audit on the financial side and whether the fees now are appropriate for that change.
Thank you, Representative. Good point. Any further discussion or further questions, gentlemen, on either bill? Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Personally, I'd like to get a little more information on this arbitration issue. Mrs. Westrom did a pretty good job of making the waters a lot
it's
muddier.
It's a lot of mud, yeah.
I'm not convinced that is, and I guess it would be nice to hear from a third party that doesn't have any interest one way or the other about the issue of the arbitration. But I'm also wondering why, instead of putting something like that in, why don't we do it more of a directive towards mediation, as opposed
would you have to back up
as
again?
Opposed to arbitration.
If you have information, Ms. Wickstrom, about the process that a student does go through if there is a complaint against the scholarship. So, can you give a comment on that?
I will after she. All right. After she speaks.
Mr. Chair, again, for the record, I'm Gina Wickstrom with the Northwest Career Colleges Federation. If you would restate. The question again?
The question is when a student has a complaint against the school in terms of return of tuition or whatever the problem is, what are the steps that the student takes?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. Currently, if an institution is licensed by the agency that drives these rules and laws, they have a requirement that they put in their publicized documents and that are reviewed and approved by that agency, that if there is a complaint, they file it with, they can file it with that agency. And usually that's the front line, is if a student is unhappy, they need to, they should first contact the school. They don't have to. They can go directly to the Department of Education and file a complaint with that agency. And the agency then begins working with the student on the complaint and the formal complaint procedure. So that's kind of the first line as I understand it. Is it's required that the institution post the complaint procedure in their catalog and other publicly disseminated information. And, sir, one other, for the accredited institutions, not just the degree, but the license that are also accredited, it's required that they have a formal complaint procedure disclosed to the students in their catalog of information and financial aid information.
Okay. But why would a career school have an arbitration clause in their enrollment agreement?
Because arbitration allows, what I understand, is arbitration, after they file a complaint with the state or whatever, if they have a concern that can't be resolved in the normal procedures as is occurring with the school and the state, that then rather than go through a court process, all right, let's go to court. That they have an uninvolved third party that comes in and hears both sides and then renders an opinion on what should happen to resolve that. Sometimes they'll, as I understand it, they certainly go in favor of the student. And then that's, of course, red flags to the state agency to go in and start looking at stuff and see what the problem is there and require corrective action. And it also is faster for the student, instead of having to go through court proceedings and all that stuff, then actually they come to some sort of resolution right then. So they agree to it so that there isn't all this stuff that potentially could go on in the court system for the students and the institutions. It saves the student time and money, and it saves the institution time and money. And you got a third party that's looking at everything. That's what I understand.
President Klim?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to speak in favor of the amendment. Essentially, you know, I own a business, and sometimes I enter into contract with clients, which is what we're talking about here. You enter into contract with your client, and what I don't think is fair about binding arbitration is that it removes court as an option, period. So I think it's fine if the business wants to put into their contract mediation is something that we as a business want to go through, and when you sign this document, you also agree to try and go through mediation. I think non-binding arbitration is fine to say we as a business want to try and go through this third party, and the student says, okay, I'm signing, we're going to try. But in the end, if it doesn't work out, binding arbitration precludes going to court.
Right.
Arbitration and mediation don't. The gentleman on the phone with 28,000 clients from BCT, if any of them had signed a binding arbitration thing, he would have to go through a massive process to break the binding arbitration agreement as an unfair sort of trade practice in order to go to court. And I share your concerns for the student. I think as long as they have the option of mediation and arbitration, if the school wants to do it, I think that's a great first step. In the end, a contingency-based attorney who's doing it on a one-third, you know, take of any judgment is going to be the best option for them if in the end it doesn't result, because they'll have no cost if their case is good enough to have an attorney take it. And I don't like the idea of taking that option off the table, which is what we would be doing by leaving the binding arbitration in as a sole method of resolving the disputes. The courts would be out of the question, and I just don't think that's an appropriate use of the contract in this case.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Greenman.
Yeah, I'd like to add to what Representative Klebs said, which I agree entirely with what he said. The problem with forcing a binding arbitration requirement on the student is that the powers are very much unequal, as Representative Hunt said. But the more important problem is that it's a totally unbalanced approach, because the business doesn't give up their right to take the student to court. For example, if they don't pay their fees, you can be sure they'll end up in court. They won't end up in a binding arbitration about whether they should pay their fees or not. So the student gives up their rights to going to court with a dispute, but the business doesn't give up their rights to going to court with a dispute. I agree. I totally support the amendments. I think arbitration is wonderful. I think unilateral binding arbitration is not very wonderful.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Brill.
I think that that may have answered some of my questions, but do we know how much the binding arbitration or arbitration at all in these cases has been used?
Mr. Chair, I did an unscientific polling of our member institutions in Oregon, and very few of them even have an arbitration clause. It's just, here's our complaint procedure, and we want you to follow it. So I don't believe that it's broadly used based upon my, you know, random calling and checking with different levels, everything from a degree granting, I mean, an associate level school, which this law doesn't apply to, but I wanted to know, down to the short-term truck driver training schools to make that determination.
So that also means, Mr. Chair, that we don't have an idea of how often this arbitration has been found in favor of the student and how often it's been found in favor of the school. And when it's been found in favor of the student, how often the school has decided that they're, because they've got deeper pockets, they're going to just drag it out or go ahead and exercise their opportunity to take it to court. So there's really a lot of information that we don't know with regards to the arbitration clause and whether or not it's really even needed.
Chairman, I'd be inclined to accept a motion to move the amendments. We still do have to move the bill to the full education committee, which would give a chance for some research to be done and some information to be provided. If the committee is so inclined to fall along with that, I think that would be a positive way for us to efficiently use our time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move the -3 amendments to House Bill 2845.
Representative Clem has moved the -3 amendments to House Bill 2845. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to vote no on the or object to the amendments. I'm not convinced that the arbitration clause is necessary. I'm also a little unsettled by the fact that the State Board of Education, I guess it's the board and not necessarily the department, that they can conduct program audits just by rule as far as what they are going to put in. I'm just a little unsettled by that, and I need a little more information on it. So I'm going to object to the -3 amendment.
So noted, Representative. We will give you another shot at this in the full committee. Any other discussion? Andy, if you go ahead and call the roll, then we'll do a roll call vote on this one.
Representative Clem?
Aye.
Representative Greenlight?
Aye.
Representative Crummell?
No.
Representative Lim?
Excused.
Chair Buckley?
Aye. The motion carries.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2845 as amended to the Education Committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Clem has moved House Bill 2845 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair, same comments as before. I can be convinced
persuaded
to vote a different way, but I think there's some more information that I need before I feel comfortable with it. So I'll object to House Bill 2845.
Very understandable. Any further discussion? Seeing none, Andy, would you please call the roll?
Representative
Clark?
Aye.
Representative Greenlight?
Aye.
Representative Crummell?
No.
Representative Lim?
Excused.
Chair Buckley?
Aye. The motion carries, I believe I will carry this to the full committee and try to explain it with the help of Representative Crummell when we meet in the full committee. And we will also make sure we get a list of questions we want to get answered.
That'd be great. Thank you.
That'd be great. All right. Go ahead and close the work session on House Bill 2845 and open the work session on 2633.
I think we already have.
We need to adopt amendments, don't we?
We do. I would entertain a motion on the amendment.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill the Dash 2 amendments. Is that correct?
Yes.
Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2633.
Representative Clem has moved the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2633. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Clem.
Just wanted to acknowledge the work of Representative Hunt's staff in the intervening time to address the concerns of this letter and presentation by Stephanie from our meeting before to get to resolution on the concerns of DHS.
Very good. Any additional discussion?
I guess I'm still trying to kind of figure out what we're trying to solve here. Because vocational rehabilitation is, can be for a variety of purposes, whether because a person's been ill and they've lost their skill, or they've gotten injured and they've lost their skill, and they're trying to learn a new skill. And I understand that the amendments are laying out the difference between vocational rehabilitation training and vocational training.
Mm-hmm.
And vocational training is just occupational or skill training. And I guess I'm trying to figure out why the Department of Human Services, other than if there is a recipient, for example, of cash assistance, and they've been instructed by the department that they need to get some kind of training so they can get off of the cash assistance program. But there again, why do we want to limit the who can provide the vocational training for them? I guess is what I'm trying to figure out. The vocational rehabilitation training, I don't have a problem with that. And it's, as you know, in with all due respects to Representative Hunt, it's more than activities of daily living. He was describing some of the things that are activities of daily living. Vocational rehabilitation is much more than ADLs. It is learning a new skill that one might need because they've lost the ability to perform whatever tasks they were doing in whatever profession or job that they had previously. And in vocational rehabilitation training, I can certainly understand why the Department of Human Services should be involved, as well they should. But in vocational training, is it because of the cash assistance programs and that sort of thing that the department would be involved, and therefore we should be limiting who can provide vocational training? Because quite frankly, when you went to Oregon State?
No,
he went to Oregon State.
Yeah, I've heard about that.
We've heard of Oregon State. Yeah. And Representative Clem got vocational training at Oregon State, and I think his training included restating their name in the sentence. But with all of that aside, I got my vocational training at the University of Utah.
Right.
Which, if I could talk about the Utes for a minute.
Utes.
No, that's okay. My point, though, is that, so vocational training is going to be a very broad spectrum. And I don't want to have an unintended consequence here of saying for vocational training that only these folks can do it, and now all of a sudden we've laid something else on the Department of Human Services that, quite frankly, they're stretched enough and don't need any more assignments.
I'd welcome, if you'd like to comment, I'd welcome the department to come up and ask. She's stepping up to the microphone, Representative. I believe if I follow the line of thought that Representative Hunt was proposing was, if the Department of Human Services, paid for by taxpayer dollars, is engaged in referring anyone in the state, that they should refer people to a institution that we have some sort of knowledge of and guarantee that it meets the standards.
Okay.
Please go ahead and please identify yourself.
Chair Buckley, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Stephanie Parrish Taylor, and I'm the administrator for the Office of Vocational Rehabilitation Services. And our concerns when we initially saw the bill was the use of the term vocational rehabilitation training. For us, that's a very broad category of services. And as you indicated, Representative Crummell, there's a number of things involved in that. For skill training, we typically utilize, quite frankly, the public institutions. By policy, we are required to use state-funded training programs, and the use of private schools is almost done by exception, and we have to justify that because of the typical cost difference. We share the concerns that Representative, I'm just blanked on his name and I apologize, the sponsor of the bill, because we have seen clients come to us who have been victimized by private vocational schools by admitting them to programs that they're not capable of completing, or not fully accommodating them, or preparing them for jobs that in fact don't exist in the economy. So we share that concern that the public be protected from, you know, I believe a minority of private vocational training schools that are not ethical in their practices. But we saw that a number of the training opportunities that we use, that we certify ourselves, would be excluded by this bill. It's everything from mobility training for someone who has a cognitive impairment, secondary perhaps to a brain injury or to mental retardation. A substantial number of people we serve are people who are entering the workforce for the first time, so there's another level of training that goes on there. We're actually preparing them for work versus retraining someone who's had a prior occupation. We provide some very specialized skill training. Someone may have been working in a clerical position, loses the use of one hand. We're looking for a specialized provider that can help them use a one-handed keyboard. We typically don't find that in the private schools. And so we wanted those individuals included to continue to have the capacity to use those programs.
So you are comfortable with
yes, we support the amendments.
Very good. Representative Clem.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, I just want to speak in favor of the amendments. What this bill does really is says that with state money, you know, these are dollars used to help somebody in their vocational rehabilitation, that we have some entity somewhere that knows about the validity of the programs offered. And then we go down and we do the list. U.S. Department of Education approved, OSAC approved, the community colleges, OHSU, career schools with an ODE, and then we leave one more exception for the current practices and policies and kind of auditing and whatever you all do to make sure you're using good facilities. And I'm very comfortable with the list. It's one I've worked with for now several years in terms of just degree validity, and this is a new element. I had no experience in voc rehab training. I'm happy to leave the experts still in charge of that part, which is what happens in the amendment with the exclusion of voc rehab training programs, and they can keep using who they're using that fits the need of the injured or you know, worker.
Thank you, Representative. Any further discussion on this motion?
Well, but the amendment doesn't say anything about vocational rehab training. It talks about it does not apply for vocational rehabilitation training. It only applies for vocational training.
Correct.
And that's the intent.
Right. What that means then is the vocational rehabilitation training and the Office of Vocational Rehabilitation Services will not be precluded from using the programs they currently use that they investigate and make sure are good before they use it. So rather than narrow too much, we're going to let them keep doing what they're doing and trust that the efforts they're doing to ensure accountability are there. Therefore, we exempt them out of our list of the only places you can use these vouchers or dollars or XYZ. We're going to say and A again on the other side of the alphabet.
Any further discussion?
We'll go ahead and do a roll call on the amendment then, Andy. The dash two amendments.
Representative Clem?
Aye.
Representative Lynch?
Aye.
Representative Trumbull?
Aye.
Representative Lim?
Aye.
Chair Buckley?
Aye. The motion carries.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2633 to the full education committee with the due pass recommendation as amended.
Representative Clem has moved House Bill 2633 as amended to the full education committee with due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Hearing none, Andy, would you please call the roll?
Representative Clem?
Aye.
Representative Greenlight?
Aye.
Representative Crumble?
Aye.
Representative Lim?
Aye.
Chair Buckley?
Aye. Motion carries. Representative Clem, would you be so kind to explain this bill to
my pleasure.
The full committee? And we can see if we can get it scheduled. Jim, we still have a little bit more work to do here. I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2633. I'm going to open up a public hearing and reopen the public hearing work session on House Bill 2579. And I believe Mr. Nelson.
We were both co-sponsors, Mr. Chair. You know.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mark Nelson. I represent Association of Oregon Faculties. Association of Oregon Faculties is an association as opposed to a union that represents all faculty on all the campuses. We have about 1,100 members. We work, of course, very closely with the collective bargaining units where they do exist on the campuses and where they don't through the faculty senates on issues of compensation and benefits. About 8 years ago, we sponsored legislation that put the first faculty member on the state board. It was a fairly large fight to do that. And you heard many of the arguments for and some of the arguments against today. We feel very strongly that there is a very major distinction between the atmosphere, the mission, the faculty at your colleges or your regional universities versus the larger universities at Portland State, Oregon State, and University of Oregon. And I believe back at that time we originally had thought we would want one individual from the regionals and one individual from the larger institutions because of that distinction. And on one hand, I agree with the chancellor that we want a statewide viewpoint, but I think we have regionals who are in fact statewide, not in the Portland regional, Portland metropolitan area, but they have a very distinct mission, many of them distinct from themselves. And I believe that you need to have the faculty on the board would reflect that distinction. I think in Jerry Richmond, who was the former and original faculty member on the state board, there was some concern when that happened that there might be the faculty member might represent only faculty views and not take it statewide. If you know Professor Richmond, you know that simply isn't true and wasn't true in her service. In fact, she bent over backwards sometimes to say, even to us, you know, I need to really take a distance from faculty from meeting with your organization on a regular basis because I need to provide that statewide perspective, and she certainly did. So we would strongly recommend and agree with AFT that this really needs to be done, and I think it will strengthen the board and not in any way weaken it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson. Gentlemen, any questions? Thank you very much for coming forward.
Thank you.
Jim, we are in a work session for House Bill 2579.
Mr. Chair, I just want to say I strongly support this motion. I don't think it in any way balkanizes the board. I mean, the board has, under this model, will have a third of its members, students and faculty. It seems a really appropriate thing to have. Two-thirds will not be. And I think the ability to provide the view from the regionals and the view from the larger universities is very, very important. And I would be happy to move House Bill 2579 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Greenlick has moved House Bill 2579 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lim.
Yes, I support this concept, but I hope in the future we don't increase anymore. I think this is good enough at this point. And then if we continue to expand the faculties, that might tip the balance. So I'm willing to support it at this time on this bill.
So noted. Thank you, Representative. Representative Lim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate Representative Lim's comments. I served a number of years on the Oregon Student Association, and the Oregon Student Association often advocated on behalf of nominations for people to be on the board, usually students. Two student seats on the board during the time I was there, and often you would get into this sort of dialogue about, well, OSU had it this time, and is the other person going to be from, or maybe I'm thinking of the Student Assistance Commission where we had our regionals. Anyway, I've been involved.
You're
in
always
thing,
thinking of the student.
And I kind of like the concept of guaranteeing a statewide perspective by having both. So what we do is we take it from one to two, and we don't just say, and the one can be sort of wherever, and the other one has to be regional. We say the one has to be from OSU, PSU, or U of O, and then the other has to be from one of the regionals. So you're sort of guaranteeing that. And I don't know how many times we sort of talked about how, oh, well, you know, U of O had it last time. It'd be nice if we did something for Southern. But it was never guaranteed in the structure, and so you'd handle the executive appointments process to try and lobby to be fair to the regionals. And often it's the regionals who end up, as I'm sure you all know, in discussions over the last 20 years. Twice now I've read newspaper articles about someone proposing, you know, one be closed, and that sets off a firestorm of activity in the regionals, and I think that having a seat at the table would promote understanding over the course of those discussions to see whether those ideas, you know, really have merit before they just make it into the newspaper. Because I had a friend follow former Governor Roberts around for, I think, 80-some town hall meetings harassing her about the notion of closing down Western. And she probably would have supported this if she knew it would have gotten Paul Evans off her back.
Thank you, Representative. Representative, any comments?
Well, I do. When I was on a faculty at Western Oregon, I never felt like the board ignored us. Matter of fact, the board came and met a couple of times on our campus while we were there, while I was there. I never felt like there was anything where the regionals were being slighted. Western wasn't being slighted. We were right next to, and I was there right before the talk started. Matter of fact, they were talking about whether we should just make it all DPSST, or whether the institution should just be closed. But then we decided that Oregon State probably needed to continue to have a decent school of education, and we provided it, so we probably should stay open. That was also a time when the legislature was talking, in all seriousness, was talking about the need for getting rid of duplication in our higher ed system, and so you had kind of the move of the different universities sort of trying to figure out what their niche was going to be. OIT had it made because everybody knew that they were technology, but everybody else was, and Western should have had it made too because, you know, we started out as Oregon Normal.
Right.
Of course, on some respects, there's nothing normal about. But anyway, I'm not convinced that this is really necessary, and I have to say that I'm kind of agreeing with the non-statement by the chancellor.
It's a diplomatic
not trying to make it board
it's a
mad.
Diplomatic.
The diplomatic statement by the chancellor in that by starting to define who is going to be on there, then pretty soon we're going to have, well, then it needs to be, you know, somebody doing this and somebody doing that. You know, the question that I have, though, I guess, is they are. The directors of the State Board of Higher Ed are appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate.
Correct.
So isn't it the Senate's job to then sort of, in the questioning part of this whole process, to be asking a person whether or not they're, you know, if they're a faculty member from Oregon State or Oregon or Portland State, wherever, but if they are going to be taking a statewide approach or they're going to be worried about their little niche, because I think if they're going to be worried about their niche, then maybe the Senate shouldn't approve them. But if they are you know, that they will take a statewide approach to these things, and maybe they can be and should be confirmed when the governor makes an appointment. I'm not sure. I'm not convinced that it's healthy to start dividing out, or as the chancellor noted, disaggregating the board. And I think the one thing that would have to happen, though, most likely, is that if 3024 were to go anywhere, then that means that most likely Portland State would, or a conflict amendment would have to be passed on this.
Absolutely.
To get Portland State out.
We'll worry about it. We'll cross every bridge, I say, if you're in front of us. Thank you, Representative, for your comments. Living in Southern Oregon, I have a slightly different perspective. I mean, sometimes we feel like we're at the other end of the world. From the centers of power, and
I mean, you're not at the other end.
Actually, we think we're at the center of the world. And,
you know, oh, okay.
So I know that the faculty members of Southern Oregon not only strongly support this, but they know where I live. So I will be voting in favor. And with that, I'll ask the committee assistant to call the roll on this motion.
Aye.
Aye.
No.
Aye.
Chair Buckley?
Aye. The motion carries. Thank you, gentlemen. I think I will keep this one for myself to explain to the full committee. We're going to go ahead and close the work session on 2579 and open a work session on House Bill 3024.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Ms. Cole.
I apologize for bringing this up. Is there a potential? There's not a potential fiscal impact with this.
2579.
2579. Because the addition of another board member, what kind of cost does that put into play?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, so far the information I have is a minimal fiscal impact, and thus. Here it is, actually. Minimal expenditure impact. So no further statement is being issued. It does not have a referral. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Wilson.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Mr. Wilson, if you would remind us on House Bill 3024.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, you have before you an updated version of the staff measure summary for House Bill 3024. I won't go into all the details, but essentially it changes the name of the Oregon Health Science University Board of Directors to the Portland Metropolitan University Board of Directors, expands the membership from 10 to 15 members, establishes PSU, Portland State University, as a public corporation under the control of Portland Metropolitan University's Board of Directors, removes Portland State University from the Oregon University System for Business Matters, and it declares legislative intent regarding Portland State University budgeting and financing. It will become operative on July 1st, 2009. We had extensive discussion and testimony on this on March 19th, and it does, as you can imagine, have a subsequent referral to the Joint Ways and Means Committee. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Members, given the fact that the report being performed for the Board of Higher Education will not be out until the end of April, I would like to just move this bill to full committee, then to Ways and Means, to give it still be in the process when the report comes out, and confer with Representative Greenlick on that, and he is in agreement with that as a process. So I would entertain a motion on this bill, if one is forthcoming.
I would be happy to move House Bill, is it 3024? I forget the number.
3024.
3024 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. I think we really, because of the lateness of that report, we really won't be able to debated in a serious way until that report comes in, and we'll run out of our time clock. Will run out before then, so I would appreciate that move to the full committee, and then to Ways and Means.
Representative Greenick has moved House Bill 3024 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion?
Representative Clem?
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to say that I am going to support the motion, though I'm not committing myself to the merits of the idea at this point. But I'm opening myself to heavy lobbying now, I know, by saying that. But I support getting the bill down to Ways and Means so that when the study comes back in, they would have it and be able to deal with it and then hear about it on the floor if it makes it there at some point.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Lim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Last session during the Education Committee, I also supported the same bill. Mm-hmm. And then at this time, I am also willing to support. Nowadays, to survive, to compete in this global economy, many banks, they merge together. And also their business, also they are merging together. They are getting bigger and bigger. And bigger does not necessarily mean better, but in this climate, apparently, that's the one of the strategy to survive. I believe merging these two institutions is not a bad idea. So we don't have nationally, worldwide known top universities or institutions in our state. Hopefully, by merging together, we might be able to bring one of the top national institutions in the state of Oregon. And the other reason I need to support this, that the Representative Greenling is my neighbor. I need to see him every day. So with all of those things, I'm willing to give my support. But that doesn't guarantee I'm going to vote for in the floor until I see some final report coming out of it.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Crowell. Any comments?
I give it to Representative Clem.
Give it to Representative Clem?
Right. No, Ibid. Ibid.
I think said give it to Representative.
No, Ibid.
Give it to you. Let me remember.
No, Ibid. I'm not enamored by the policy, but I won't stand in the way at this point, and let's see what the report says.
Thank you, Representative. If our committee assistant will please call the roll.
Representative Clem.
Aye.
Representative
Greenlick.
Aye.
Representative
Trumbull.
Aye.
Representative Lim.
Aye.
Chair Buckley.
Aye. The motion carries. Representative Greenlick, I assume you might be willing to bring this to the full committee for us?
Yeah, it's not that heavy, it's my brother.
Thank you, Representative. I'm going to go ahead and close work session on House Bill 3024, and if there is nothing else before us, then I will adjourn this hearing. Thank you, gentlemen.
Productive.